Imagine this, getting up every day and facing a day in which people treat you with fear and suspicion and perhaps is intellectually limited. The National Association of Black Journalists is taking a close look at the whys and wherefores and remedies of these misperceptions of black men and boys in what it calls the Black Male Media Project. Locally, the Greater St. Louis Association of Black Journalists and St. Louis University's Office of Diversity and Community Engagement have organized a weekend event, a panel discussion, as part of the National Dialogue. With me in studio, Sharon Stevens, longtime education reporter with KSDK and a former colleague of mine at KTVI. She is currently reporting and producing for HECTV here in St. Louis. Also in studio, Jonathan Smith, the Vice President for Diversity and Community Engagement at St. Louis University. Thank you both so much for being here.
Thanks a lot for having us.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Jonathan, let me start with you. Do you think that I misrepresented the situation in the introduction by talking about waking up every day and facing suspicion, fear?
No, I don't think you misrepresented it. I think that's a thing that many of us who wear the kind of body that I wear face on a daily basis. So I think that's not a misrepresentation, but it's not the entire story. And I think that the project that we're engaged in is a way of helping us to see a more complete story about what it means to be black and male in the U.S.
In a sentence or two, what part of the story is missing that we should be talking about?
In a sentence or two, I think it's the part of the story that's about us waking up and carrying ourselves through our family relationships and community and work relationships with joy and with health and with contentment.
The part of the story that's missing is that's not being told. What's being told through the media largely, Sharon, to you, is a different story. It's the negative story.
Well, not only that, but it's more often than not the negative story. There are a lot of stories out there talk about good folks who are doing good things, or at the very least trying to do good things. And I think that's always been the goal of the National Association of Black Journalists. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons we were founded in 1975, to make sure that we advocate for those kinds of stories. Nobody's trying to sugarcoat anything. You know, there are problems out there.
Well, sure, of course there are. But why aren't these stories being told?
Well, I think part of the problem is that there probably aren't enough of us in the newsroom pushing it, because that's what it takes, coming up with the ideas. Not enough people listening. Someone comes to you with an idea, says, hey, I've got this great idea to talk about something positive that a person is doing in Jennings or Northwoods or, you know, some place where a lot of people have never been. And it doesn't seem to always catch on with those in power. And sometimes we don't push our own stories. We're not blameless here. Sometimes we don't get up there and say, listen, I really have something to say. We're really trying to do something here.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that has come up a lot on this program the last couple of years, Jonathan, since Ferguson, since the Michael Brown shooting, has been the fact that the situation in that community concerning fines and fees and the way people are treated, social injustice issues, was that it caught so many people by surprise. Not the black community, because they've lived with it, but it caught everybody else by surprise. And that's sort of astonishing.
Right. Yeah. I think I've been in St. Louis nearly three decades now, and I've known multiple people in my family, and a nephew who for traffic tickets was one day shuttled from municipality to municipality. As a young man actually, I think he wasn't even out of high school at the moment, but he shuttled around from municipality to municipality as though he is a hardened criminal, when it's really just a matter of either a late registration or a few miles over the speed limit. And those are the kinds of things that for many of us were just not a surprise at all. But for so many people here in the St. Louis region, for so many black people in the region, it had just become the way things were. And it's just such an ordinary fact of existence that you it's not news when it's a part of your daily existence and everyone you know experiences that same thing. You cease to think about it as news or as surprising or as something that's out of the ordinary or worth mentioning just because everyone you know experiences that.
Sharon, the media can be criticized for not having gotten that story long before the Michael Brown shooting, don't you
think? No question about it. It's been out there for so long. It was no secret about what was happening in some of these tiny courts. Not at all. But the interest wasn't there. And again, the push wasn't there.
Well, can we deduce from all of that that the push wasn't there, but nor was there the will on the part of management, if you will, media management, to go after these kinds of stories? There's a certain invisibility quality to people who are poor, for instance, and people who are, you know, kind of downtrodden. We don't see them.
That's right, and I think that's still the case. I think back to when I went to college eons ago. I was on a campus where there were only 200 African-American students out of 20-something thousand. And I really understood Ralph Ellison's book, The Invisible Man, because it was right there in my face. I was, okay, this is it. And it persists today. You know, I'm not here.
Mm-hmm. And, Jonathan, there's a lot of code work going on as well. One that immediately comes to mind is you talk about North St. Louis. You're saying more than a geographic location. You're saying a lot more when you put that in a news story.
Right. When you put that in a news story, you're telling people a lot about race, about crime, about the moral capacity of a group of people. You're telling people stories about how much a community cares for itself. And we've developed many strong ways of coding that here, and I think St. Louis has become very expert at coding race, religion, class, and socioeconomic status in some very simple, innocuous terms like the high schools, the neighborhood names, references to county versus city. Mm-hmm. We've developed a very efficient code for putting so much work into how we understand the people that we live and work with. And that makes some of those people occasionally deeply invisible and at other times really hyper-visible. So there are ways in which we see young black men in North St. Louis as being hyper-visible in terms of criminality. But we don't see that aspect of black community, of black male fatherhood that has always been a strong cord in black community. So these days, black fathers, whether they are co-resident with their children or not, tend to be more involved on a daily basis than other fathers. But we have this persistent myth that guy is not there and that caring father doesn't exist unless he's somewhere in an upper middle class or college educated framework.
So Sharon, how do you generate that push? I mean, obviously, the black journalists nationally and locally want that to happen. How do you do that?
Well, first of all, I think that you keep talking. A lot of times, I'm sure, Don, you remember this, we'd have a morning meeting and talk about what news we should cover for the day. And not everything that one might suggest would be accepted, you know. But the idea to me is to come back the next day. Mm. To keep talking. In fact, after you leave the meeting, go in, talk with that news director, whoever the producer, whoever it happens to be, and say, listen, I really think we need to cover this, and here's why. You have to keep talking and not give up about it. Do other people have to do this? Well, you know, in some cases I would say so. But I think we have to sometimes do it a little more.
Do you sense that's changing at all? I mean, you're recently removed from Channel 5. Had you been aware?
Don't say removed, Don.
Let's retired from Channel 5. Whatever, you're no longer there. But have you sensed over the recent years that there's been a change in this regard?
I sense some change. Certainly, we are seeing, you know, more African Americans, more people who are Asian and Latino, who are on the air. And again, another goal of not only our organization, but the organizations that represent other ethnic groups. So that's a plus. That is a plus. But, you know, we're still not seeing a lot of people in management or ownership, for that matter. How many Oprahs do we have? Bob Johnson, who used to own BET. So we still have a ways to go. I do see a difference a little bit in the stories. Although sometimes some of these stories, and I'm not saying it should be, you know, that black people should just cover black stories or white people or what, you know, it's not like that. But I think
it used to be. Wasn't that long ago.
That's right.
Send the black reporter out on that story to North St. Louis.
Right. That's right. Yeah. That's absolutely right. I think that sometimes we bring that idea forth. Everybody's voice is a little different. I'm not saying that, you know, you couldn't cover a story in North St. Louis as well as I could, Don, but I probably might have a little bit more of a connection. It's not anything other than that. But you know what? Sometimes I go out to cover stories. I would go out to cover stories in predominantly African-American communities, and they didn't want to talk to me either now. You know, there's no guarantee.
I
think one of the issues here really is about how do we cultivate sources within communities to be the voices that represent their communities for themselves. So simply being African American, as you mentioned, Sharon, doesn't necessarily get you into a community. And a part of projects like this really is to open up the idea and open up for people what it means to be black, that it's always much broader, that it's not monolithic, it's not two-dimensional, it's multidimensional. And I think when we think about stories today and when we think about what has happened here in the last three to four years now, one of the places I think we really have to look is social media and how out of the events of Ferguson and out of the Black Lives Matter movement, there's been the development of this new brigade of citizen journalists and of young black citizen journalists who during 2014, the fall of 2014, they were a very present source for media and news. And there were many moments during the fall of 2014, if you wanted to have the most up-to-date, the most up-to-minute live news of what was happening within our region, you needed to be tuned into one of the live streamers because they were embedded in the marches, in the protests. They were embedded on the front lines, and that's where those voices were. And our traditional mainstream reporters in many instances were outside on the borders. And so it really is about cultivating voices within communities. And on some level, that's how the media has always worked, but it's only been a smaller set of communities.
Right. You know what? I was just thinking one of our panelists will be a young man named Bradley Rayford. This is the kind of thing we're talking about. Bradley was cultivated through the Greater St. Louis Association of Black Journalists when he was a college student. He came into our training program. And he was all over the place after Michael Brown was killed. He was all over the networks, and he was, you know, he had his own camera, his phone, his everything. He's streaming. It's a wonderful example of that kind of thing. And that's part of what this panel discussion is about, cultivating this kind of thing. And I think he's a good example.
But the next question is having acceptance, general acceptance of what is being reported from someone like this young man.
Right? Yes, that's correct. He was trusted to the extent that when he popped up on CNN one night, I went, oh, my goodness, it's Bradley.
Yeah, but there is a tendency, I think, on the part of some to be suspicious because someone comes out of that environment and is doing the reporting, well, they're going to have a bias. It's going to be slanted.
I think that people do think that, you know. Right. And I think reporting has changed, you know, a bit over the years, too. I'm always amazed to hear so much opinion in reporting these days, but that's another story.
Right.
But that also surfaces and through the social media. I mean, I see an awful lot of commentary, Twitter tweets that come from people who are reporters who are expressing opinion, and they shouldn't be.
Right. I believe that, too.
And you know, that's black, white, any size, shape, or color.
Right. Yes.
How about from academia's standpoint of view, Jonathan? I mean, you're looking at this from a somewhat different perspective. What are you seeing, and what do you see that can be changed through organizations like Black Journalists?
Well, I think it really is about broadening the audience for stories and giving people additional images to consume. So one of the problems with how we understand the black male image is that they're in many cases either an absence of certain stories, there are only the negative stories, and there's an underrepresentation in some spaces. And one of the things that many of us academics are well equipped to do is to provide additional stories to tell about what the experience of African American people, of men, women, boys, and girls have been like. So it's a way to it's about finding a way to get people to go see Fences and add that to their repertoire of how they understand black masculinity, so that the only ways they understand it aren't just those images from the negative images from the news or the images of athletes or popular entertainers.
Or when you're looking for an expert, do you think of calling Dr. Jonathan Smith first? That kind of thing.
Right.
You know, there certainly is, I've noticed a tremendous change in this regard on cable television. I see a very significant number of black experts who are now popping up, and that wasn't the case as recently as a year or two ago. I mean, I think it's really been a marked difference and a change. Not so much in the local level. We're talking, Sharon, about men and, you know, stereotyping and that sort of thing. But it seems to me that the same thing applies to black women.
I think so, too. We have one woman on the panel. We'd hope for another person, but she had another obligation because we thought it was important to hear her voice as well. Mm. This, I think, is just because of the images we have of black males in society, the national organization said, let's hit this first. Let's start with this. But you're right. The same could apply to black women, and we see some of the images on television, particularly on the entertainment side, that I shake my head. I can't believe it. You know, we've got to toss a head and twirl a neck and, you know, sure, call each other names. I don't know. Come on.
Well, that part of the media, the show business, the entertainment part of is also a big part of the problem. Over the years, it's always been a case that stereotyping on the sitcoms and what have you, which has done more harm, I think, to the black community than good in most cases.
I think it's less about certain images having done harm than still the idea that there are not enough images. So if we think about the wide variety of sitcoms that tell the stories of the lives of middle-class white America, there's always been a broad spectrum. So no one sitcom, no one artist had to bear the cultural and racial brunt of having to represent the entire group. And I think also one of the things, and here I think is another space for academics to jump in. There are times we've actually had more representation than we remember, right? And we've had different images than what we tend to remember. So Good Times, for instance, if you want to talk about black fatherhood, the sitcom Good Times is just an absolutely wonderful show. And we can choose when watching Good Times to either concentrate on the fact that they're poor and in the projects, or we can choose to concentrate on the strength of that particular family structure. And that image has been out there, and it's been out there for a number of years. And for every popular artist we can point to, you or anyone might want to point to as a negative stereotype, we could probably go person for person and bring up people who have in a popular space served as counterbalances to that.
John Amos played the father a number of times.
Yes.
He was a high school classmate of mine.
Oh, really?
Wow.
we played football together. And every time I see him on the tube, he was in Roots, and the guy was in everything for a long time.
Yeah.
Every time I see him, I can't believe it.
Right.
I went to high school with that guy. Let me give some information as time begins to wind down for us on what's happening. The Greater St. Louis Association of Black Journalists and the SLU Office of Diversity and Community Engagement are hosting a panel discussion, conversation about the image of black men and boys in the media and in American society from 2:30 to 6:30 p.m. this Saturday, June 10th at St. Louis University. Who's on the panel?
Okay, well, we've got Bradley Rayford, as I mentioned. Tim Lampley, who is a local freelancer, is our moderator. Tanya Mason, who is a producer and editor at HEC-TV. Art Holliday, who has been at Channel 5 for almost 40 years now. And Eric Cox from Channel 4. Then we're going to have a second panel in the afternoon, which Dr. Smith will be moderating. And we're going to have a young student from Harris Stowe, Tyel McNary, also Dr. Stefan Bradley from the St. Louis University African American Studies Department. And Richard Gant, who was an actor, is going to be in town. Marlon Wharton from Gentlemen of Vision, which is a program that focuses on the lives of African-American students in Riverview Gardens. And a young man named Corey Edwards, better known as Slow Down.
I have someone here has just tweeted, said a question about the involvement of Corey Slow Down Edwards, a member of the St. Lunatics rap group.
That's
on
right.
Sunday.
That's right.
We only have a minute left. What does he bring to the table?
Well, I think he brings the voice of a certain age group in America. Kids are listening to the music that he's involved in. Mm. They want to hear what he has to say, and he has a concern himself about, you know, how black males are portrayed.
What about the issue, and again, we have a minute left, the issue of role models? There are a lot of them out there, but not enough.
I think there are enough. We just all have to get involved. Part of what we hope to do is to foster training and mentorship programs. If they don't exist, you know, let's help them, you know, become created. If they do exist, let's get more people involved.
Well, you had a pretty good one, and for 8 years, and Barack Obama.
Yeah.
That certainly is helpful. And have Lester Holt now doing NBC News.
Sure.
That's helpful.
Yes.
They are out there. You know, we have to wind this down now, but I want to just make the point that you didn't talk about music and the importance of music. We're going to go out on one of the most important music figures of this century ended. Not just ended. It's been a while. But to the 20th century, Chuck Berry. We're going to pay tribute to him because it's a big day in his world as well. Many prominent musicians and bands with lasting contributions hail from the St. Louis area. Scott Joplin, Miles Davis, Willa Mae Ford Smith, and Uncle Tupelo are just a few. But if one were to rank just one of the St. Louis musicians at the top of the list, it might be Chuck Berry, one of the pioneers of rock and roll.
Back in the 60s was a little too queen. Fell down a lassie in love with a lad. Till it took him to vindicate the feelings she had. She pleaded and she promised every prayer she could. Till everybody whispered to her lady.